Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The search is on for a governing consensus in Burkina Faso. An appeal is in the works in the Oscar Pistorius case. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Opposition leaders in Burkina Faso have called off protests as they continue holding talks with the country's military leadership on forming a government of national consensus. Opposition leader Zéphirine Diabré said the army had promised to propose a transition process. He says the opposition will then review the plan and the dialogue will continue. The military took control Friday after longtime President Blaise Compaoré resigned in the face of protests against his effort to amend the Constitution to allow him to run for another term. South African state prosecutors have appealed the conviction and sentence given to track star Oscar Pistorius. Pistorius was found guilty of culpable homicide in the shooting death of his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp last year. Last month, Pistorius began serving a 5-year sentence, but South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority says it has filed an appeal. It said it could not discuss the matter publicly until judgment is delivered in the court. Some in South Africa think the conviction and the sentence are both too light. The AFP News Service reports that South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and his Sudanese counterpart Omar al-Bashir have agreed to resume work on drawing a border between their two countries. Mr. Kiir arrived today in Khartoum for the talks following last week's flare-up of South Sudan's civil war. The civil war is of interest to the Sudanese since it has reduced Sudan's oil output and earnings. This is VOA News. The AFP reports that Boko Haram is suspected in attacks today in Nigeria's Gombe state. The attacks targeted security services, a bank, and a political party office. The AFP reports fighting between the Congolese army troops and suspected Ugandan rebels. The rebels are suspected of recent killings in the country's east. The violence broke out Monday when the army-backed rebels believed to be planning an attack on the town of Beni in North Kivu province. Government ministers today appealed to civilians in the DRC's eastern areas not to form militias to protect themselves, fearing that such groups would complicate the situation. A Kenyan priest and 4 other people were found guilty today of murder in the death of an Italian bishop, Luigi Locati. The AFP says the murder happened in central Kenya about a decade ago. Prosecutors believe the bishop was killed in a dispute over church funds. Father Wako Guyo was named as the mastermind behind the murder. The Associated Press is reporting that Botswanan opposition parties are charging President Ian Khama with undermining the role of parliament in the selection of the nation's vice president. An opposition coalition known as the Umbrella for Democratic Change said today the president's request that the parliament elect the vice president by a show of hands is a form of intimidation. Botswana's court will rule on the matter this week. Zambia's new president, interim president Guy Scott, has taken back his decision to fire the chief of the ruling Patriotic Front Party. The removal of Secretary General Edgar Lungu from party leadership sparked political conflict and overnight violence in the streets. Lungu should remain in place at least until after the November 11th burial of President Michael Sata. He died in London October 28th while seeking military help. Voters across the United States are casting ballots in an election that could determine whether Democrats or Republicans will control Congress during President Barack Obama's final 2 years in office. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives and a third of the Senate's 100 seats are at stake in today's elections. A pro-Russian rebel leader was sworn in as the head of a self-declared People's Republic in eastern Ukraine today. The swearing-in of Alexander Zhakarchenko as prime minister of the so-called Donetsk People's Republic worsens a crisis between Russian-supported breakaway regions and the Ukrainian government. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Guinea authorities say they are planning to move the country's main Ebola treatment center to a larger site. The center has been overwhelmed by new cases in the past month.
That's VOA's Karim Kamara reporting. Details coming up.
Also, opposition leaders in Burkina Faso continue holding talks with the country's military leadership on forming a government of national consensus.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Kenya, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, is doubling its staff in the three West African countries where children are more than 20% of the virus's victims. In New York, UNICEF's Ebola coordinator, Dr. Peter Salama, announced a staffing increase of 300 workers. Schools are closed in much of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea due to the epidemic. Death is all around them, Salama said. An estimated 4,000 children have been orphaned by the virus that has killed an estimated 5,000 people. In Sierra Leone, the UN mission on Ebola head, Anthony Banbury, warned that if people don't stop touching the sick and the dead, a custom in many communities, transmission of the virus will continue. If people don't change that behavior, Banbury said, more people will continue to die.
Scientists gathered yesterday at the National Academies Institute of Medicine in Washington, D.C. They discussed the need for more research on basic assumptions being made about Ebola transmission. Delegates raised questions about whether the incubation period could be longer than 3 weeks, whether someone without symptoms could spread the virus, and whether hand sanitizers and bleach used to kill it could make the skin more susceptible to Ebola. The stigma of fear of the Ebola virus continues in the United States, where only one person has died of the virus. Some of the 4,000 scientists and health officials expected to attend the yearly meeting of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene in New Orleans last weekend were disinvited by officials of the state of Louisiana. The state warned those who have been in any of the three West African countries in the past 3 weeks to stay away from the conference. Any who attended would be quarantined. At least 10 health workers planning to attend stayed away. One speaker at the conference opposed the threat of a mandatory quarantine in her address to the conference. Conference organizers also opposed the quarantine order. They said the state's quarantine policy should be changed quickly to lessen the stigma among the American public. State officials in Maine have reached a compromise after threatening mandatory quarantine for a nurse who returned from working with Doctors Without Borders in Liberia. Case Hickox can now travel freely as long as she continues to test negative for the virus and reports the results to public health officials.
The international medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known by the acronym MSF, gave us an update on the Ebola situation in the three most affected West African countries. They say while there have been slight improvements reported on the ground in Liberia and Guinea, Sierra Leone has seen a significant surge in reported cases in recent weeks, with every district now affected. James Kambaki is the human resources representative for Doctors Without Borders. From Johannesburg, he provided me with an update on the Ebola crisis in West Africa.
I think we can see the most improvements in Liberia. I think there's a lot of efforts that have also been put there. That's also where MSF is having the biggest isolation centers. And apart from that, MSF has been distributing kits, like protection kits, to the public. So that could have made an impact. And besides that, MSF has also done a mass malaria prophylaxis, that prevention at least tries to ease up the burden of other illnesses so that you can concentrate on Ebola. So far, this seems to be working, but we have seen a bit of a drop in terms of admission in our isolation centers. We're trying to investigate why we have this drop, because we don't consider that the epidemic is now reducing, but I think there's also policies that have been passed by the government, which is compulsory cremation of bodies, and maybe the population, they're not keen in taking that up. So we may tend to see possible decline of this. At the same time, you see that the public transport has also been affected, because most of the taxi drivers who have been bringing patients to the hospital have also been infected, and some of them have died. So the numbers of public transport that used to bring patients to facilities has reduced as well.
You mentioned that you all are giving out protection kits. Can you tell us what is in those kits?
Those are things like gloves and masks and chlorine, which is also used for washing hands. It's a quite effective disinfectant against Ebola. They were targeting about 300,000 families.
Now, looking at Sierra Leone, you have now acknowledged that Ebola has spread to all of the districts there. Why does Ebola continue to spread in Sierra Leone?
That's also where MSF has been running the facilities in Calhoun and also started another one in Bo. But I think the government response has been hampered also by the lack of resources and coordination, both the national and the district level. So there was no strong surveillance system that was put in place. With so many Ebola deaths, we are seeing increased number also in orphanage children, homes and centers where they lacked also caregivers. So it's a bit of an upskill right now in Sierra Leone. In terms of international response, of course, we're beginning to see this coming through, but I think it's slow and it's also uncoordinated, which makes it not easy to have a direct impact right away. There's so many factors into this that makes Sierra Leone situation getting worse than better at the moment.
Looking at Guinea, has Guinea become stabilized now with the Ebola crisis?
Conakry is where we see it has stabilized a little bit. The surveillance there is actually working. We are seeing that the cases are not really increasing, but it's still not under control. So MSF is also trying as much as possible to construct new treatment centers that are in a place called Donka, where we have some other new cases. So Conakry is stabilizing, but other places in Guinea is not under control.
Also, if you could just briefly touch on the latest Ebola situation in Mali.
Mali, there was one case that the person has so far died. And MSF, because we have a project in that country as well, MSF has gone into assisting, putting up centers so that we can try as much as possible to control the epidemic before it gets worse.
A couple of months ago when we talked, you had mentioned how people were afraid to go to healthcare facilities for fear of getting Ebola. Is that fear still there, and are people following precautionary procedures?
The fear, of course, is still there. And what is more now, we're actually seeing also fear of the people who have recovered, because until now, over 1,200 people have been discharged from our facilities. And they have to go back to the community. So there's that fear that this person has had Ebola before and is still going to spread it, which is not true. So there's that fear of discharged patients, and also there's stigma also and fear of health workers who are working in these facilities from their families that they are actually going to spread the disease as well. So this is a little bit change of trend right now, that the stigma of patients being discharged and the staff working in these facilities they are facing at the moment.
What do you see as the most critical gaps right now?
We can say still everything is still a gap. We did not really see a lot of these isolation centers start providing services. We know that other aid organizations have come in, they have started constructing isolation centers, but the services have not yet started to actually give that necessary impact. We also see a gap in training of health staff. We see quite a big gap, of course, on infection control, because the kits, the distribution of kits that we're doing in Liberia is one thing, but we need to also educate them on how to use them and how to actually control the infection. Contact tracing is still a big gap. Epidemiological surveillance is another one. Alert and referral system is still a big gap. Community education and mobilizing is still a gap. So I can just say we still need everything in those three countries.
That was James Kambaki, Human Resources Representative for Doctors Without Borders. He spoke with me from Johannesburg.
Guinean authorities say they are planning to move the country's main Ebola treatment center to a larger site. The center has been overwhelmed by new cases in the past month. VOA's Karim Kamara took a tour of the center and met with a woman recently cured of Ebola who explained her ordeal.
The Ebola Treatment Center at Donga Hospital in Conakry has more than 70 patients admitted. The center has only 48 beds. Many of the sick are not from Conakry, but they came here to seek treatment. The National Coordination Team Against Ebola says it is opening more treatment centers across the country to stop patients from coming to Conakry. This center at Donga Hospital is also being moved and expanded. 30-year-old Damfron Safi, an Ebola survivor, was treated here. She said the hardest part of her ordeal came after she was released. She says when she was released, the situation was painful and she wanted to return back to the center. She says she found she had already been rejected. No one wants to be near her or have contact with her anymore. She says she has been totally stigmatized. Safi has tested negative for Ebola. She is no longer contagious and considered immune to reinfection, but her family rejected her. She says she lost her job as a teacher. She said school authorities told her there is no room for her in the classroom because with her presence will mean the school will be stigmatized. So she has come back to the treatment center where she is helping doctors care for patients. She provides emotional support and tries to reassure patients that they can be cured. She tells them not to be afraid of doctors who, for safety reasons, must wear head-to-toe protective gear. Safi is one of about 600 people believed to have been cured of Ebola in Guinea. She says Guinea must do more to help survivors. She says it is not an easy task to treat an Ebola patient, but now, she says, is also the time to help those cured from Ebola to have their place in the society. This regional epidemic started in southeastern Guinea last year, and it has spread and continues to resurge in various parts of the country. The capital, Conakry, continues to report new cases as well as several towns in the southeast. Guinea has opened new treatment centers in Forikaria and Kindia near the Sierra Leonean border. Each center has 20 beds and 10 doctors. President Alpha Conde says Ebola will be kicked out of the country by the end of the year. Schools remain shut. Health workers continue to complain that the government is not paying their allowances. Karim Kamara for VOA News, Conakry.
When it comes to fighting viral outbreaks or even stopping water shortages, healthcare applications which integrate real-time analytics, data centers, and messaging platforms are poised to improve the critical initial response to epidemics and natural disasters. Lizabeth Pala has more from Uganda's capital, Kampala.
The first line of defense against deadly viral outbreaks, water shortages, and food scarcity might just end up on your phone. A new application called mHero, created in Uganda, combines health worker registries, patient data, real-time monitoring, and open messaging systems to ensure a fast and integrated response. mHero stands for Mobile Health Worker Electronic Response and Outreach. It uses a revolutionary messaging platform called RapidPro that employs trigger words to contact specialized workers if a disease like Ebola is discovered. It also allows users to track whom they've reached and create real-time analytics based on their responses. A few weeks ago, Uganda experienced an outbreak of Marburg, a viral hemorrhagic fever similar to Ebola. Sean Bashki, a health system specialist with UNICEF, explains how Uganda has excelled in providing quick containment.
You can see with the case of Marburg here a couple of weeks ago how quickly the country mobilized suspected cases were followed up in hours, and it didn't move beyond a single index patient. I think Uganda really does, show and provide a model for the rest of the world on how you could build a national sustainable health systems architecture. We're very excited because this was these tools that are now being scaled up in West Africa originated in Uganda, were built by Ugandans. These solutions came from Africa and are being used in Africa.
The Ugandan Ministry of Health says that in the next 3 months, mHero systems will be deployed around Uganda. MHero has a wide application since it can broach language and literacy divides by using picture-based references. Nimrod Wandera, a software developer, explains how those with zero experience using smartphones and applications were trained in MHero.
So we thought about an app as a box, okay? So we made a box. We made a box out of hard paper. And that box was covered, and on top of it was the name of the app. Okay? So you have a box, and then you tell someone, okay, when I give you the phone, yeah, I'm giving you a box. And that box has things in it. What we call features were small boxes inside that box. And they find mother reminders, they find household survey. And when you give them back the phone, life was much simpler. They could click through, they could understand that nugget and go out of this box and go back into the bigger box. This is real stuff.
To access these databases, registered healthcare workers, NGOs, and clinics must fill out an application from the Ministry of Health, and approval comes shortly after. There are also stopgaps in place to ensure that patient medical records are kept confidential. Officials are hoping that MHero and apps like it bring a new level of crisis management throughout the African continent. Lisbeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Opposition leaders in Burkina Faso have called off protests as they continue holding talks with the country's military leadership on forming a government of national consensus. Opposition leader Zephrine Diabri says the army has promised to soon present a document outlining a transition process. He says the opposition will then review the plan and the dialogue will continue. The move comes as the African Union's envoy to Burkina Faso, former Togo Prime Minister Edem Kodjo, met with opposition leaders in the capital, Ouagadougou, to begin discussing a way out of the nation's democratic crisis. Yesterday, the AU threatened sanctions if the country fails to return to civilian rule in 2 weeks. The AU's Peace and Security Council will meet in 2 weeks to consider sanctions and could suspend the nation's membership and ban travel for the military leaders.
The military took control Friday after longtime President Blaise Compaoré resigned in the face of protest against his effort to amend the constitution to allow him to run for another term. It appointed Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida as interim president. The opposition says Lieutenant Colonel Zida told them he will lift his suspension of Burkina Faso's constitution, which would lead to a constitutional council, asking all sides to propose an interim leader. The African Union has joined the opposition in saying a new interim leader must be a civilian. A joint mission that includes the UN, African Union, and the Economic Community of West African States said in a statement it is encouraged by the commitments of all sides to work together to organize a transition.
The Libyan military reports an oil tanker in the port of Benghazi was struck by rockets fired by Islamist militias on Monday. The army spokesman identified the vessel as an oil tanker, although other witnesses claimed it was a naval vessel of unknown origin. The port has been closed to all maritime traffic for 2 weeks during clashes that have killed more than 200 people. Benghazi is Libya's second largest city and the birthplace of the nation's 2011 uprising that ousted longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi. Forces loyal to the internationally recognized government of Prime Minister Abdullah Al-Thani have for weeks sought to retake Benghazi from Islamist militias. The parliament has been meeting in the eastern port of Tobruk since Islamists and fighters from Misrata took the airport and government buildings in the capital, Tripoli.
There may soon be a rapid diagnostic test to determine whether a person was bitten by a venomous snake. There are no reliable numbers on how many people are bitten by snakes each year. One study in 2008 estimated the figure to be at least 420,000, with up to 94,000 deaths. But experts believe those estimates are probably too low. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Venomous snakes are common, Researchers say they pose an especially serious unresolved health threat to millions of people in South and Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But there was encouraging news in New Orleans at the annual meeting of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. A DNA test has been developed that takes a swab from the fang marks on people bitten by snakes. Researchers say the test correctly identified the species of the biting snake 100% of the time in a first-of-its-kind clinical study. Dr. Ulrich Cook is with the Institute of Occupational, Social, and Environmental Medicine at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, and part of the research team. He wondered if the same type of DNA tests used to catch criminals might be used to identify snakes. Of course, for it to work, you need lots of snake DNA.
We do need reference material, reference DNA sequences for each and every species of snake that we deal with, at least for one geographical region or one country where we work. In parallel to collecting samples from bitten patients in hospitals, we also need to find the snakes, and we need to take samples from those snakes to get the same genetic information on the particular snakes. So that's really biodiversity research meeting clinical research.
The current test would not be used for rapid diagnosis and treatment, but it is expected to lead to that.
We use this genetic test as the gold standard, in addition to any dead snake brought to the hospital by the patients, to determine the species identity of the snake involved in the bite. And that is crucial information to inform clinical research, in which we validate very rapid diagnostic tests where we compare treatment methods to find out which treatment is better and more cost-effective for the patient and the hospital.
Cook says it would be a dipstick test, similar to a rapid pregnancy test. It could be either a blood or urine test.
This type of test detects venom, and venom can be detected in the blood of the patients or in urine or from the bite site as well. Now, we are going for a blood test because snake bite patients, when they reach medical care, they have one blood sample taken for clotting tests and some other laboratory examinations. So you can use the blood from the same sample to do this diagnostic test.
He says it's far better than what's happening today in many developing countries.
Unfortunately, the current method globally is not being treated at all and not seeing any medical help at all. Snake bite envenoming is really one of the most neglected of all tropical diseases. Although it causes a huge burden of disease and a very high death toll every year.
He says the challenge is to connect snake bite diagnostics to primary health care in the most affected countries. He says adequate snake bite management is only practiced in a few locations around the world. Cook describes snake bites as a disease of poverty. Many of those who are bitten are the breadwinners of their families. If they do not die from the bite, they may lose a hand or a leg. If they do find treatment, it's likely to be very expensive. Cook says in Africa, for example, snake bites can place a strain on already overburdened healthcare systems.
In many of those areas, 1 out of 10 people admitted to hospital is there because of snake bite envenoming. And those are patients who are critically ill, who occupy hospital beds for a long time. They need a lot of attention, and that strains healthcare resources a lot.
Also, most snake bites occur in rural areas of poor countries, far from urban areas where most health clinics are located. The tests could lead to the stockpiling of anti-venom in strategic locations. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Opposition leaders in Burkina Faso continue holding talks with the country's military leadership on forming a government of the national consensus. And the UN Children's Fund is doubling its staff in the three West African countries, where children are more than 20% of the virus's victims. Coming up, we have music from Kenya, and in our feature segment, cuts in domestic budget makes it hard to help orphans and to address domestic violence and teenage pregnancy in Sierra Leone. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Vuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots and lots of African football news for us today.
Lots of African football news on the plate this evening, Kim. Joining us once again on the Voice of America from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny, and good evening to all the football lovers around the continent.
David, still a lot of doubt swirling about the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations tournament and whether Morocco will go ahead and host the tournament because of Ebola fears. Where do we now stand?
Sunny, the new D-Day is Saturday, November the 8th. Morocco basically have been given 5 days to make up their mind, and they have a straightforward choice, Sunny. They either host the Africa Cup of Nations on the original date, January 17th to February the 8th, or else they must withdraw. And if that's the case, CAF have to find a new host. Now, the time span is incredibly short. It's just over 2 months to the kickoff. But the impression I've had over the last couple of weeks, Sunny, is that Issa Hayatou, the CAF president, he's quite a wily, old, crafty operator. He's been in charge of African football, jeepers, longer than I can remember. I think it's 1988, in fact, is when he started. And he constantly springs surprises. And there was a lot of media reports, Sunny, particularly in the Moroccan press, that, in fact, CAF were going to agree at a meeting in Rabat to postpone the tournament by at least 6 months until June 2015. But in the end, nothing of the sort. CAF stuck very rigidly to what, in fairness to them, they've said from the very start, and that is there is no change to the dates. It must go ahead in mid-January to early February. Now, Sunny, on your previous edition of your show, I identified six of the seven countries that letters had been sent to asking those countries if they were willing to step in as emergency hosts. And if we look at them again, South Africa have declined, so have Algeria, so have Egypt, and so have Sudan. So there's four countries who have declined. The mystery country I finally discovered just before coming on air is Gabon, who, of course, were co-hosts of the 2012 Cup of Nations. Now, they haven't said publicly yes or no. And it's a similar situation with Ghana and Nigeria, two West African countries. One hears reports from Ghana that the public there are not keen on the idea of the Cup of Nations because of the threat of Ebola, which has now claimed almost 5,000 victims, the majority, of course, in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Nigeria have kept pretty quiet about the issue, but as things stand, Sunny, it seems as if Gabon, Ghana, and Nigeria have not come out and said, no, we won't host it. So perhaps Hayatou is looking at one of those countries to come to the rescue, or else Hayatou has got an ace up his sleeve. I've just been trying to imagine what might be going on in his head. And although South Africa, Sunny, have said no, the Minister of Sport, Fikile Mbalula, he was very clear on that. He sent out a tweet in which the word no was repeated twice, and it was in capital letters. I wouldn't be surprised if CAF are really battling now to find a host, if they're going to have another attempt at persuading the South Africans who are... You need two things, essentially. You need the infrastructure, which South Africa has got. It's ready-made. It's there. They have it from the 2010 World Cup. And you also need a degree of competence in organizing something at such short notice. And there are certainly other countries in Africa besides South Africa who can do that. But the South Africans are used to this. They're sort of the specialists at emergencies. They did it in 1996 when Kenya withdrew because of financial problems. And, of course, when it became impossible for Libya to host the 2013 Cup of Nations, South Africa stepped in at short notice. So, Sonny, while accepting that the South Africans have said no, I wouldn't rule them out completely. I also have a sixth sense that Nigeria could be the country that will host it. Looking at that situation, I cannot believe that CAF have thrown down the gauntlet to the Moroccans without having a backup plan. Otherwise, the competition would have to be cancelled. And how do you explain that to all the countries who spent hundreds of thousands of dollars playing in the qualifying competition, and at the end of it all you say, sorry guys, there is no Africa Cup of Nations tournament, but thanks for competing anyway. I think that would be a risk too far for Issahaya to. So I'm sure he's got a plan B. I just wish, Sonny, I knew what it was.
David, it's been a great year for Algerian football. The country's national team, nicknamed the Desert Foxes, kick sand in the faces of many World Cup experts by reaching the round of 16 at football's premier event in Brazil. The Desert Foxes currently ranked number one in Africa, also unbeaten in Africa Cup of Nations qualifying. And at the club level, Algerian fans continue to have a lot to cheer about. One of their clubs lifts the CAF Champions League title. VOA! Tell our VOA football fans about that, David.
Yes, Sonny, it was a close call, but Algeria have done it. Anton Satif, Champions of Africa, way back in 1988. 26 years ago, Sonny, but they've done it. They did the hard part, basically, in Kinshasa in the first leg by forcing a 2-2 draw. They twice led in that game, and two goals from Mabidi brought V Club of the DR Congo back into contention. And Satif started the second leg as if they wanted to get the job done and dusted within about 5 minutes. They swarmed all over the Congolese. They forced a free kick and a corner within 60 seconds. There was a header from the Algerians that was cleared off the line within 2 minutes of the match starting. And I thought to myself, watching it from here in Johannesburg on TV, jeepers, the Congolese are going to get slaughtered here in this match. And as always, Sonny, in Algeria, a capacity crowd and very vocal supporters indeed, and also very partisan. Every time the Congolese touched the ball, the whistling began. But slowly but surely, Vita got into the game, and then 5 minutes before halftime, they actually had the best chance of the first half, but the shot was blazed over from the edge of the penalty area. And then 4 minutes into the second half, Satif did push ahead, a goal at the far post by Yunus. It was a low cross, two Algerians missed it, but there was a third there, and he did score. And I guess that's a lesson for all footballers to get men into the box when you're attacking. It was nice, I think, for Satif that although two of their players missed, there was yet another player there to convert it. Now, Sonny, the Congolese were in real trouble because under the away goal rule, they had to score twice. A 1-1 draw was not going to be enough. And within 5 minutes, they leveled with a great goal. The Algerians rather tamely cleared a cross, and the ball fell to Mabidi, and he hammered the ball into the net. A superb goal, and quite an achievement. Lema Mabidi, he didn't really feature all that much in the goals department in the build-up to the final, but now he has scored 3 goals, 2 in Kinshasa and another one here in Blida. Vida, in the closing stages, were actually the more progressive side. They were pushing forward, looking for that second goal, but it just wouldn't come, Sonny. And their last chance was a free kick in the first minute of stoppage time. I'm sad to say, not an area of expertise, I'm afraid, for many African clubs. And the ball was fired well off target. And the match, in fact, finished with Sétif on the attack. So a 1-1 draw in the second leg, 3-3 on aggregate, and Sétif win on the away goal rule. And interestingly, Sonny, that's only the second time in 50 finals of the Champions League, and previously known as the African Champions Cup, that the away goals rule has dictated the winners. And on the previous occasion, it was actually a Congolese side who benefited. It was TP Mazembe back in 2009. They played Heartland from Nigeria. Heartland won the first leg in Nigeria 2-1, but lost the return match 1-0, and therefore Mazembe won on the away goals rule. But considering that 10 finals have been decided by penalties, when I started looking up my facts, I was a little bit surprised that only 2 have been decided by the away goal rule.
Voice of America!
From all at the Voice of America, congratulations to Anton Sétif of Algeria, African champions, and also well done to V Club. They are 2 clubs that nobody, myself included, really expected to get to the final. We had our usual suspects as the favourites. We had Al Ahly of Egypt, we had Esperance of Tunisia, and we had Mazembe of DR Congo. So Sétif and V Club did very well to get to the final. And both matches, Sonny, very enjoyable. In years gone by, a North African side playing away from home would basically just pack their own half of the field and make very few attempts at attacking. But Sétif were quite the opposite. They attacked repeatedly in Kinshasa. And in fact, if anything, they were probably the more defensive side in the second leg. And it was the Congolese who were pushing forward. But 2 very enjoyable games indeed, and good advertisements for African club football.
David, who were the leading scorers during the 2014 Champions League tournament?
That was a little bit disappointing, Sonny, given that every team played 12 to 14 games, but the leading scorers only managed 6 each, and they were Mubele of V Club, Bellemere of Sétif, Juini of Esperance, and Ngassa of Young Africans. Now, Ngassa is an interesting case in point, Sonny, in that in the very first round of knockout play, the preliminary round, in fact, he scored 2 hat-tricks. He scored them against a team from the Comore Islands. Young Africans won that tie 12-2. In the next round, round of 32, Young Africans were eliminated by Al Ahly. But despite that, the 6 goals scored by Ngassa kept them either on top initially or as one of the leaders right through till the end. So congratulations to Ngassa, a striker who plays for Young Africans. They're sunny on the east coast in Dar es Salaam, the capital of Tanzania.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Sending it back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, cuts in domestic budget, making it hard to help orphans address domestic violence and teenage pregnancy in Sierra Leone. And next, a conversation with the 2014 Human Rights First Award recipient. But first, some music. Here is Nathaniel Niagol of Kenya with Africa.
Continent of unity, peace, love, happiness, come see Africa, come see the beautiful land, come see Africa.
Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful land. Africa, the homeland of the animals, the birds nesting on the trees, singing, it is farming time, singing, it is harvest time, Africa. Come see Africa. Welcome to the beautiful land. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful land. Come see Africa. Welcome to the land. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful land. Freedom and democracy. We fight for human rights, respect and dignity, justice for everyone, Africa. Come see Africa. Welcome to the beautiful land. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful. Come see the beautiful land. Come see Africa. Welcome to the
Nathaniel Niagol of Kenya with Africa.
Well, according to local press reports, the Sierra Leone government has announced a 23% reduction in 2015 ministry budgets. That includes the Ministry of Social Welfare that oversees care for children who have lost their parents to the Ebola virus. Simeon Sandy, a regional gender officer in the eastern part of the country, tells Ricky Shryock that will cut off his office's ability to help those orphans and to address domestic violence and teenage pregnancy.
We are manning the psychosocial and the child protection and gender in the Ebola response. Vis-a-vis, we are providing social support for all survivors and even affected persons. And we are doing the rapid registration of children, orphan children, to households.
How many orphans has the ministry so far counted from the Ebola crisis?
For only Kenema district, because I'm covering Kenema district now, I've recorded over 400 now.
Where are these orphans going? Are you finding problems putting them into homes? Is there a social stigma attached to these orphans?
What we are doing now is these orphans, we have an inch in care. For instance, we are finding caregivers in these communities. This is Africa. We have extended families. Maybe a relative of the parents who died will be willing to take these children, to provide care for these children. So we are placing them in this care.
And you're not finding people are less willing to take in these orphans than other orphans, for instance, because of the stigma attached to Ebola?
Yes, you're having a lot of problems. A lot of people don't want to take children because of the stigma. But there are some relatives who are willing.
So there is this talk of reducing the budget by 23% because the Sierra Leone government has had a reduction in income due to the Ebola crisis. Are you guys already working on a low budget? What kind of care would have to be cut off from Ebola survivors or Ebola orphans?
It's going to be really, really hard because all of the programs are really, really important. But because of Ebola emergency, I think we're going to concentrate more on the Ebola response because there is everything in Ebola. There is child protection in Ebola, there are gender issues in Ebola, there are social issues in Ebola.
What kind of other issues have you guys had to put on hold for now because of the Ebola crisis?
One of the greatest challenges now, that's what we are holding a workshop on, is the increased rate of mortality rate. Infant mortality is on the increase because a lot of people don't come to the health centers again for institutional delivery. A lot of them are really, really afraid. Their whole thought is that no sooner they come to the health centers, they'll be coming like categorized as Ebola.
That was Simeon Sandy, a regional gender officer for the Sierra Leone Ministry of Social Welfare. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Kanena, Sierra Leone.
Sudan has been bombing its own people in the Nuba Mountain region for 3 years now. It started when Nuban citizens mounted an insurgency after a national election they believed was rigged. The violence forced international aid organizations to pull out, but one young American stayed. Recently, 33-year-old Ryan Boyett was recognized for his efforts, receiving the 2014 Human Rights First Award in New York City. VOA's Carol Van Dam has more.
As NBC Nightly News anchor Brian Williams presented Boyett with the award, he told the audience a little about why Boyett decided to stay behind when the other aid workers were leaving.
The people of Nuba not only felt like family, they had really become family when Ryan married Jazeera, a Nuban woman, just before the conflict started. With aid organizations gone and a government ban on media access, Ryan knew there would be no witness to the atrocities. So he formed something called Nuba Reports.
That's a team of citizen journalists founded by Boyett who, according to Human Rights First, record the brutality of the Sudanese regime. They then post their footage on social media websites and share it with news organizations like NBC and VOA. Boyett says he was surprised to receive the award.
You know, I live in Sudan. I'm in the middle of a war zone, so I don't really think too much about awards, but When they told us, I was really quite humbled.
Boyett eventually added professional journalists to Nuba Reports who are armed with nothing but video cameras, solar-powered laptops, and satellite phones.
There's still a war going on between the SPLA North, the rebels in the region, and the government. But the bombing is taking place in civilian areas. And there's constant bombardment.
And Boyett says the bombing campaign intensified shortly before the rainy season began, not only in the Nuba Mountains, but also in Blue Nile and Darfur.
Just before this past rainy season, which started in about June, there was more bombing that we've seen in a three-month span since the beginning of the war. So it's actually increased.
Boyett says there's a reason the government stepped up its bombing campaign at that time.
At the exact same time, there was a huge push by their new force called the Rapid Support Forces. And that push caused many people to be displaced behind the front lines and moved back into the caves, and those caves were being bombed. So it was in conjunction with this massive push by the Sudan government into the region.
Leaked documents published by the Associated Press indicated that top Sudanese generals were targeting agriculture fields to starve the people out.
Just about 2 weeks ago, 15 bombs were dropped inside an agricultural field, which destroyed thousands of acres of crops that people farmed.
Boyett says the Nuban people were able to feed themselves before the bombing campaign started.
The sorghum is their main crop, and it's starting to dry out so people can harvest. Well, one bomb dropped in the middle of a dry sorghum field is going to ignite and burn thousands of acres.
The government maintains Nuban communities are harboring rebels who must be stamped out. Boyette says one action does not justify the other.
Every family has someone that's usually in the SPLM North and within the rebels in the area. But this does not justify them bombing innocent civilians. We're talking about collective punishment. You have a group of people that no matter where they stand politically, they're being bombed, they're being destroyed. They're being starved out through the bombing of their crops.
Boyette and his team continue to risk their lives to expose the government's bombing campaign against the Nuban people, hoping to galvanize worldwide attention and general political will for long-term change in Sudan, not only in the Nuba Mountain area, but also in Blue Nile and Darfur. The Sudan embassy in Washington did not return our phone calls for comment on this report. Sudan President Omar al-Bashir was recently nominated to be the ruling party's presidential candidate for a fourth term in office. Carol Van Dam, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
A strong promoter of spreading democracy abroad through free and fair elections, the United States turns its attention homeward this week with important balloting of its own across the country. The November midterm elections will determine which political party controls the U.S. Congress and 36 state governorships. President Barack Obama isn't on the ballot, but the outcome of the national races will have a big impact on his policies and achievements in his last 2 years in office. This year's election comes at a critical time for our nation. It is the first since Russia invaded the Ukraine. A militant Islamic insurgency took control of large swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq, and the shadow of West Africa's Ebola fever epidemic touched our shores with the return of infected travelers and healthcare workers. Polls indicate that because of concern with these and other crises, American voters will go to the polls in a sour mood. Many may not even cast a vote at all. Midterm voter turnout is always smaller than when presidential candidates are on the ballot, and given popular discontent, that trend may continue. Or maybe not. The next Congress will be asked to take fateful votes on war and peace issues that will affect every American. The impact will be felt not only in congressional action in the immediate future, but it could provide potential presidential candidates with clues on how to govern if they run in 2016. Important state and local issues will also be on the ballot, such as raising the minimum wage, allowing casino gambling, spending more money on education, and legalizing marijuana. With such high stakes, political parties and candidates have spent billions of dollars to get their messages out and appeal for support. In several states that allow people to vote by mail early because of Election Day conflicts, the balloting has never been higher. Even with their discontent over the nature of politics today and unpopular government policies, Americans know elections are the best way to have their voices heard. That is the essence of democratic government, and a right that, the nation's current mood or not, few Americans would surrender.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat.
Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.